Hi, Drew and Jonathan Scott here.
Reminding you that a lot of life's firsts are better with help from American Family Insurance.
Like your first home expansion.
Or your first big lightning strike.
There's a first for everything. Get the right home policy at the right price with the right help from American Family's agents.
Life's better when you're under American Family's roof. Insure carefully, dream fearlessly. Get a quote and find an agent at AmFam.com.
Products not available in every state. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.
Hey, Kristen, how's it tracking?
With Carvana Value Tracker.
What else?
Oh, it's tracking. In fact, Value Surge Alert, trucks up 2.5%. Vans down 1.7%.
Just as predicted.
Mm-hmm.
So, we gonna...
I don't know. Could sell, could hold.
The power to always know our car's worth.
Exhilarating, isn't it?
Tracking.
Always know your car's worth with Carvana Value Tracker.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to So Very Wrong About Games, a board gaming podcast about board games. With me is the most erudite man in the room, Michael Walker. How are you doing, Walker?
That's me. Yeah, I'm doing great.
I'm glad to hear it. A couple of housekeeping announcements, a couple of community bits of feedback. Number one, a couple weeks ago, when talking about Coloretto, the most excellent filler by Michael Schacht, I committed a grievous error, all the more grievous because it's one that I keep making. I think I've made this mistake at least once before on air, and I make it all the time in common parlance. I attribute to Michael Schacht the board game Clans by Leo Colavini. Leo Colavini, he of Karuli Maguni, Chucky Mags, Charlie Big Big, El Carlos Grande, Carolus Magnus. And Michael Schacht, on the other hand, has done Coloretto and Web of Power and all the derivatives.
That's probably why that Coloretto box fell on the floor. It was like in disgust.
So I can't take it anymore. Ah! Yes. So my apologies both to Michael Schacht and Leo Colavini, and by extension, the entire Swag community for that misattribution. Another area where we've gotten repeated bits of feedback, in the classic example of the internet, many, many instances of people pointing this out, and ranging all the way from, were you aware, to, since you were obviously too stupid to know. We got all the range of the smugness here.
Don't forget that. Actually.
I talked last week about a game of Guards of Atlantis where a number of characters could create tokens and hem us in, among them Razzle, who spawns various other versions of herself. And a number of people said, well, clearly you forgot about the clear rule. We knew about the clear rule. We had several discussions about the clear rule in the context of our game. We just weren't in a position to use it because spending an attack action to then make way to go get to the minions, which we would then not be able to kill because our attack action is gone because of the clear, didn't make sense. And so actually inaction made more sense, which I think is vindicated by the fact that we ultimately won the game. So there. Yeah, no, we actually talked about the clear action in the context of, ooh, I'm surrounded by tokens. And I was like, oh, the clear action, it's new. It's new, the new clear action. Yeah, yeah, we know. So thank you very much for those of you that pointed it out in a spirit of helpfulness. Go get a better hobby for those of you that pointed it out in a spirit of smug condescension. And thank you, Artem Nechiporov, designer of Guards of Atlantis, for pointing it out as well. So we were aware of the clear rule. It just didn't make any sense in that context. In the one context where I was surrounded and couldn't make any forward progress, it's because I was surrounded by copies of Razzle, who is not a token and not subject to the clear rule.
Not only that, it opens up a lane for your enemy to now come and attack you after you've used your attack.
Well, funny you should mention that, yes. Independently of the wasting of the attack action necessary for the clear, it was the case that the round after we were hemmed in, after the push happened and it was pushed back into the central battle zone, our opponents had a great deal of difficulty navigating their own tokens. And so they found themselves in a prison of their own making. So it worked out very, very well. And yes, we removed tokens between rounds.
Yeah, careful.
Yeah,
we'll get another barrage of emails.
Yeah, actually, yes, please send all your emails to Board Game Barrage. They will be happy to deal with any such instances. Now, moving on, this is a board gaming podcast about board games. We're going to be talking about the games we played last week. We're going to talk about the news and why it doesn't matter. We're going to talk about our feature game, which is Rebirth by Reiner Knizia. I'm looking forward to Walker trotting out his one joke about Reiner Knizia. Walker, what did you play last week?
Mark, we streamed a game called Finspan. And just so people know, at the end, we played a game called Lunar, which I'll be talking about later. But Finspan is sort of an offshoot of Wingspan. They are very similar, like in Wingspan, where you have a lane that's going to activate lane of the eggs, and a lane to draw cards, and a lane to get resources. All that they've changed is the lane to get resources. Instead of getting the resources, you're hatching some of the eggs that you've laid, which become a resource of smaller fish, which not only can you use as resources, but you can start moving them around and pooling them together to become schools of fish, which will be points. Other than that, the gameplay is very much similar. They've sort of broken down the lanes into sort of sections. Instead of filling it up completely to get better actions, you're sort of putting fish in the three different sections to engage a better action. If you like fish more than birds, then you'll like Finspan. It was kind of interesting having a little movement mechanism where you're moving these little tiny fish tokens around. That was kind of interesting. But other than that, more Wingspan.
Yeah, for those of you that are aware of people who wanted to like Wingspan, but it was a little too gamerly, because Wingspan, look, it's a relatively light hobbyist game, but nonetheless, it's more dense than a lot of games that people are accustomed to. Finspan does seem to be more accessible in terms of rules load. The problem is, though, that I don't think that fish excite the same enthusiasm that birds do, frankly. And that's one of the reasons why Wingspan was such lightning in the bottle, because I like people who never expressed any interest in board games ever, but were secret bird aficionados, were like, hey, have you heard about this Wingspan thing? It's like, yeah, I've heard of Wingspan.
There's a lot of fish I've never heard of before, so it's interesting learning about new fish, I guess.
There's always other fish in the sea, Walker.
Apparently.
Yeah. I was disappointed to hear, I didn't play Finspan, so I'm not in a position to comment substantively, but I was very disappointed to see that there are fewer eggs in Finspan than there are in Wingspan.
Yes.
My comment was, you can't run a sushi restaurant that way, so.
No, you cannot. And I was disappointed the fact that you don't have a heads-up display of fish or birds, as you know, in Wingspan, you have this large, you know, face up display that you get to choose from. Finspan is off the top of the deck, so
yeah, it reduces the arena for choice.
Yeah. Yeah,
there's a way to make games lighter without negatively impacting the decision space, and then there are ways to make the game lighter that just remove decisions and agency from you. And sometimes both have their places and their merits, but broadly speaking, obviously, I would prefer more of the former than the latter, but. Reducing people, making sure that people don't have to choose from a whole bunch of cards, especially for non-gamers, they might get paralyzed a little bit. I don't know. I'm not in a position to comment.
True. Just so people know, there's this, you know, all the things that Wingspan had, like they have fish that will trigger every time you activate a certain lane, fish that will get you points at the end of the game, fish that will give you benefits when you play them, all the same sort of things that were in Wingspan.
Question about the art, though. Do they exclude, let us call, the less photogenic fish?
No.
Creepy.
They're very ugly.
Living fossil.
There is this thing called the pygmy seahorse.
Okay.
It is truly horrifying.
Well, now I have to look it up.
So, Finspan is designed by David Gordon and Michael O'Connell and published by Stonemeyer Games.
Oh my goodness.
I told you.
This is horrifying.
It is nightmarish.
Oh, well, some of them are cute. There are a bunch of pictures here. Some of them are absolutely horrifying. Some of them look like they belong in the breakfast cereal. And some of them are kind of cute. All right. Pygmy Seahorse. As featured in Finspan. Started another campaign of Slay the Spire, the board game. This is the board game adaptation of the PC game of the same name, designed by Gary Dworetsky, Anthony Giovanetti, and Casey Yano, published by Contingent Games last year. And I am finding it to have the legs that we hoped it would. This is the second campaign that we've started since we've identified Slay the Spire as game of the year, and my enthusiasm doesn't wane, and I pulled out the initial blessings. What you start with is a function of Meow's blessing. Meow is a weird kind of undead whale god figure. It's tough to tell, right? I'm not knee-deep into the lore of Slay the Spire. It's a large whale thing that seems to resurrect you to throw you into the wood chipper.
But it's not your mom, though.
Meow gives you blessings, and in this particular case, I got to take two cards off of my rewards deck, one of them from the rare rewards deck and one of them from the normal rewards deck, and I ended up with Envenom and Dagger Spray. And for anybody that knows the card game, I was so enthusiastic about this initial pull, I was kind of bragging slash marveling about it to Efka Bladukas from No Pun Included, and his response was basically, yeah, at that point, why don't you just put the game away? You're kind of done. He basically was negging my choice, implying that only a true scrub would continue at that point. I am that scrub. I will happily continue. Now, sure enough, the first time I really needed that awesome combination, Dagger Spray was the very last card in my draw deck, and so it took me a long time to get there.
Yeah, you used up all your luck drawing the cards.
Yeah, exactly. Then, yeah. At that point, it was all downhill from there. But I am more than happy to engage in the Power Fantasy version of Act 1 of Slay the Spire, and that's more or less what happened. Act 1 was very, very, very breezy as a consequence. Act 2 may pose a greater challenge, but as it is, the first boss died with, I think, 28 poison tokens on it, and I was just getting started, so we'll see how much poison we can get to from here on in. I then pulled up a whole bunch of other cards that key off of poison. I stumbled in as well afterwards to a number of other cards that proc into some other build aspects of the Silent. So the Silent was the character class that I was playing. And there's a variety of different kinds of sets of tricks you can build a deck around, but they need the necessary prerequisites. For example, there are a whole bunch of effects that trigger off of being able to discard cards. The Silent discards cards a lot. And so there are a bunch of cards that are unplayable, but if you manage to discard them via other effects, they do a variety of neat things. The Silent also has a power that says at the top of your turn, draw a card and discard a card, which is already great in a deck builder anyway, even independently of the fact that you need to discard things. I have that power as well. So basically all the tricks that the Silent gets to manipulate, I've stumbled into. As I frequently say, I would rather be lucky than smart, but I'm still very much enjoying Slay the Spire, even when it doesn't really pose much of a challenge. I should note, though, the one area where my character is not overpowered is I am not assisting my colleagues at all. I just have my own damage-dealing capability, and that's about it. Sometimes people are like, is anyone able to pass any defense to anyone else? To which my response is, nope, solve your own problems. 5 more poison on the boss, please.
Yeah, I'm all about beating him down.
Exactly. So that's Slay the Spire, the board game, still having a blast of a time. Looking forward to Act 2 of our new campaign.
So I returned to Dice Throne Missions. This is sort of, there's a game called Dice Throne. It's sort of like a battler, a Yahtzee battler against other people. This introduces sort of like a cooperative mission element. So once again, we went against Doc Ock because he destroyed us last time. And it went the opposite way. We went through the henchmen fairly quickly, got into Doc Ock. And this time he didn't roll as egregiously as he did last time and got beat down. It showed some of the backs of Dice Throne, though. Like, in Yahtzee, I don't mind Yahtzee. I love Yahtzee Online because you can cycle through it very quickly. But unlike Yahtzee, you don't get, your choices don't start to go down. You know what I mean? Like, you've already got your small straight. You don't need that. So you have to push to get different things. So it's all you already have that. You don't get this in Dice Throne. You always have everything open to you. So a lot of the times you just roll. It's like, oh, I just fell into, you know, and all of the skills are roughly the same. You know, you have your super ultimate, of course. That is a lot. But anything else is relatively the same. So that sort of didn't make it as fun, but still kind of interesting for a sort of attack Yahtzee game, if Yahtzee is your thing. Otherwise, I really would pass. This is designed by Gavin Brown and Nate Chandler and put out by Roxley. What Missions introduces is it has a map, so you're actually moving a figure around a map. It has a new thing called Momentum, which allows you to get sort of allies, so it, you know, fills out the Marvel Universe with all these different cards that give you other ways to spend your dice and other abilities that sort of fill the gaps that your, you know, character might be less in. I think I'm still going to play it. I think it'll be mostly a solo type experience because it, you know, sets up quickly, plays well, and it's one of these things where you don't have to keep looking up the rules. It has a great turn summary. You just cycle through, move on, and the, you know, all the bosses, much like these superhero type games, all have sort of unique, interesting mechanics, how they manipulate, how they do the last turn. Anyway, that's Marvel Dice Throne Missions.
Finally played Star Trek Into the Unknown. This is a tabletop miniatures game in the Star Trek universe with a very expensive but blinged out base game with very large pre-painted starship miniatures. And Walker's copy, unfortunately, arrived sans dice. And since the game relies very heavily on custom dice, we had to wait for WizKids to send replacements, which they eventually did. And it's got two 50-page rule books, one for the introduction and one for the actual full game. And so there was an additional bit of daunting rules load there, especially considering that the advanced rule book is not available in physical form. It's one of those miniatures games things where the rules are only available online.
Yeah, they claim they're going to make it a living rule book, so much like the Blood Bowl one, which I love, because it's constantly updated. So that's good. So whether they do that or not, it remains to be seen.
We'll see. So we only got to play the baby intro version, and like many miniatures games in the baby intro version, instead of having a full fleet, you have a subsection of that. So in this case, it was just two ships and two of the smaller ships. But one of the reasons why we were excited about Star Trek Into the Unknown, at least on my part, was that it has a greater emphasis on the crew of these ships, because it recognizes that unlike a game of Attack Wing or even a game like Armada, having just a single activation for a large capital ship doesn't necessarily make a whole heck of a lot of sense. It might make sense at a certain scale, but it would also make sense to emphasize the fact that different stations are crewed by different individuals, and different stations will be able to activate sometimes several times over the course of the round, because they are very, very large. I mean, you know, some of them are basically flying cities anyway. Not the ones we were playing. We had the Defiant against a Jem'Hadar fighter. I'm sure that means something to somebody. I vaguely know what the Defiant is. I'm not really a DS9 guy. I'm more of a Star Trek The Next Generation guy. But anyway. So I very much appreciated that attempt to grapple with scale. And the scenario also had a potentially interesting dynamic whereby there's this notion of aggressive acts, where whoever shoots first or aggresses against infrastructure of the other player will cause the game to accelerate in a certain way and might change the posture of various players. So, for example, I was playing as the Federation, and I just wasn't allowed to engage in hostile acts without losing a whack of points. And I would just lose them flat. Walker, on the other hand, when he engaged in an aggressive action, he lost points, but in the process, he removed one of my victory conditions from the board. He basically big-leagued one of my satellites. And so, yeah, he lost some points, but it also took some points of mine out of contention for scoring at all. But what that did was, it gave me the justification, the provocation, to go all out. Now, this could have led to some interesting dynamics. Had we known more, this was a learning experience. Had we known more about the situation, maybe in Walker's shoes, what I might have done is got real close, powered up all my weapons, and engaged in a massive initial salvo, some kind of ridiculous preemptive attack, and hoped that that would cripple my ship or reduce it to such operating capacity that it could either then finish me off very soon thereafter or just leave me to putter around on my own on fire while he went and satisfied all the other victory conditions. Now, on top of that, as I said, it focuses a lot on the crew, so you get different crew cards. The army building seems primarily about choosing which crew to staff your starship. They have skills that make some things better, other things more expensive, and special abilities, etc., etc. My primary concern is this. All of that is great, and all of that is very different from your average run-of-the-mill, boring, derivative skirmish game. I will play a skirmish game any day of the week, but it's very easy to make a derivative, boring one.
And then quickly on top of that, like Mark pointed out, to give you the scale of a large ship, not only do you get all of the, you know, this person's going to do this because they're in that, you get to move them around to the different stations. But then after you've activated all of these crew members, you also get sort of like a general action to sort of show that, you know, you have all this other crew and you've said, it's okay, you're going to, everyone else, you know, man the guns. And so they get, you get this
staff
one,
the guns.
Yeah, you get this one general action.
Yeah, absolutely. So the part that leads to considerable concern is that a given starship, and again, they're grappling with questions of scale and theme, has a dizzying array of statistics and numbers. And it was the case that various actions require very specific things. Like, okay, so a given starship might have about 10 stat lines. It's like, okay, how does this test work? Well, this test, you roll this many dice and you get this many rerolls, where it's two, not arbitrary, but somewhat counterintuitive numbers from the sea of different numbers they have. The iconography to differentiate the numbers is also not particularly good. For example, right off the bat, I was explaining the game to Walker. It's like, okay, well, you can move in impulse power, you can move in warp. Your range for impulse power is, I can't remember, let me look that up, because I'm looking at this starship dashboard and it's an endless sea of numbers and icons.
Or how far can you turn when you do impulse? It's like, well, where's that? And we're looking at it.
Right.
And it's like, oh, this little arrow with the number that's under underneath your impulse power,
yes,
that you need a microscope to see.
That's, it actually, yeah. I seldom complain about how small numbers are represented. These are very, very, very tiny bits of information. And that doesn't just make it harder to execute basic actions. It means that I'm concerned about how good your decision-making can be given this noise of information. Set aside fleet building. We don't have to worry about it. We've only got the starter set, right? So it's three starships against three starships. Fine. We don't have to choose which ones we want. That's okay. And then we just have to choose crew, which is slightly better presented in terms of information. But it just means it's like, okay, I want to go do this thing. What ship should go do that thing? I don't know. There's a lot of numbers going on. I'm not sure which should do what. This one's larger. Does that matter? Oh, maybe not. Yeah. So I'm a little intimidated by the prospect of the full game. I'm vaguely curious because, again, it does things that other skirmish games don't do as well it should. It tries to represent the Star Trekiness of it all in a very serious way, and I really respect that. Like, the fact that Star Trek Attack Wing was basically like X-Wing is fine, but I'd rather that a miniatures game be evocative of the source material in a substantial way, and both in terms of scale and focus on posture and beaming crew over and hailing frequencies and crap like that. Like, I'd rather that be in there. The question is whether that leads to a smooth gameplay experience with quality decision-making. I don't know. I am perhaps at this stance cautiously optimistic.
Yeah, I'm wondering how many times you need to play it for it to go smooth, and then how often you have to keep it up for it to remain that. Because there is, like you said, there is a lot. I really love the fact that there is many things to do. It's just not go and blast each other. There's anomalies that you can scan. There's other things that are going to happen. Like you said, you can hail them, which is going to manipulate this, you know, objective type thing. Are you going to be more aggressive or less aggressive? There's locking on, there's sensors, all of these things. And like you said, not only is it sort of gives you the feel of a Star Trek universe, it gives you the feel of the Star Trek episodes, because it's like this crew member is doing this, is firing this gun. Mm. This one is turning the ship. The captain is telling everyone else what to do. It's like what would happen in an episode.
And I was very pleased when the first damage card that got pulled was exploding console. And anybody that's watched any Star Trek, you know what an exploding console looks like. So I was just imagining the sparklers in the console and some red shirt diving off to the side. Yeah. So that was Star Trek Into the Unknown. I would try again. Again, cautiously optimistic. I'm not a huge fan of the current setting. Like I said, the Dominion War doesn't do much for me. There's going to be an expansion that's probably also going to be $1 million that has some Klingons in it.
$99 for four more ships. Yeah. $25 per ship.
Yeah, but Klingons, Walker.
Yes.
Consider Gowron. Gowron has 42 pieces of flair.
He does.
And Kartok with Martok.
Yes.
The quality, the meme quality of the available Klingon memes. I haven't even talked about Tea Time with Worf yet.
This is all true.
Anyway, the memes demanded. So that's Star Trek Into the Unknown by Max Brook and Michael Gernis, published by WizKids this year. Probably try to get it to the table again, but it's a bit of a lift. So we'll see.
It is. So the game I was talking about earlier that we streamed, so if you're interested in very interesting trick-taking games, just go to the end of the stream on our live YouTube channel and you'll see us playing Lunar. So how Lunar works is that you need to play with four people and you're playing in teams, and you're going to get six numbered cards and six suits. So if your partner plays a suit, that means you have to play a number. And so you go around and things will change. It's like, well, you know, I played a two, so we're probably going to lose. But the other team played purple, and my partner's void in purple, so they play a trump. So suddenly we're winning. And it has that dial that a lot of trick takers have, that if you win 0 to 3 tricks, you're going to get 10 points. And then 4 to 5 is 0.
Mm.
And then 6 is you both get 5. And then you have 3 more openings. So it would be 7, 8, 9 is 10 points again. And then anything more than that is back down to 0.
Woof.
So you got this, you know, crazy sort of windows to get points. Then on top of that, some of your suit cards will have stars on them. And I think all of the threes have stars. And stars are just straight up points. And so it's first to 30, depending on how many rounds you play. I really enjoyed Lunar. Very, you know, different sort of look at trick-taking games. This is designed by Matsuo Yusugi and published by Allplay. Lunar.
The conceit alone makes me very tempted. I would love to try Lunar. It sounds great. On the topic of interesting trick-taking games, we played Lone Wolves again. This is a review copy we got from the publisher, and this is a two-player-only trick-taking game where there's a weird, almost spatial element. There are these columns that you're fighting over, but you don't play to the same columns. Walker leads with a card. I have to follow suit if I possibly can, but I don't have to follow to the same column. And you're fighting over the columns in a sort of an area majority way. If you lose the trick, your card gets flipped face down and it's only worth a one. You never want to lose a column. That's not something you're looking for, but there are absolutely reasons to throw a certain trick. Number one, if you lose a trick, you get to activate a bonus token in the column where you played. The first trump is determined when a column is absent any bonus tokens, and so that in turn influences where you want to play. I love these little tensions and trade-offs, like, well, I'd like to win the trick, but if I can't win the trick, I'd like to lose it over here. And on top of that, there's this restriction that any given column can only have a maximum of 6 cards in it. And this helps you lock something down. You might throw some garbage cards in there because you're already winning, or you might throw some garbage cards in there because you want your garbage to go somewhere, and you'd rather clog up the place where you're already losing rather than a place where you might be able to make a solid fight. Anyway, it is very quick, very visceral, lots of good trade-offs. It's a single hand, but it doesn't feel as arbitrary as a single hand of other trick-taking games feel. Like most of the time in a trick-taking game, you need to play a number of hands to even out the luck of the draw. But so far, I've been pleasantly surprised by how balanced a single hand feels. It's not the most deterministic thing in the world, but it seems to shake out relatively okay. And the time commitment is minimal, and similarly, it uses the fundamental conventions of trick-taking to make you reevaluate card play, which is what a lot of these quality hobbyist trick-taking games of the past few years have done.
Yeah, I love the determining the trump part where, you know, once all the tokens are gone from a certain lane, then you're going to put a moon token there. Not only is that lane now worth more points.
Yeah, significantly more points.
But that, and all each lane is tied to a suit. So that that lane is worth more points, and now that particular suit is trump.
Yeah, I want to slough off to that lane, but in so doing, that would make it trump. I don't have any cards of that suit. I can't make that suit trump. Okay, that's another restriction or consideration about how I play these cards. Absolutely.
Yeah, this and that happens twice per game, and it plays very quickly.
It does.
It's
just what happens when you're losing a trick alone? Like, someone's running the table, right? They're leading all the high cards, and there's nothing you can do to win the trick. Even then, you have a lot of decisions to make about how to play your cards. I actually found in our last game of Lone Wolves that having to lead, I was in a position where I led the first 3 or 4 tricks. It felt terrible because I was just ceding the board to you. You could just go take whatever bonus token you want because you kept losing all those tricks. It was very interesting in terms of dynamics.
Yeah, I was losing because some of the tokens are very interesting. Like one was the Lone Wolves, which when you lose, you flip over. Your cards are worth 1. So it made each one of those Lone Wolves worth 2 points each at the end of the game.
Yeah, so it only contributes 1 point of strength towards winning the column, but independently of whether you win the column or not, it's going to be worth a flat 2 points at the end of the game. I never played to that column because it was just stuffed up with garbage by the time I considered it. It was weird.
Because I knew I was losing, so every time I lost, I'd just keep funneling cards into that lane, and now they're each worth 2 points.
Yep.
It was interesting. There's other cards like that, one that will let you each column is worth a certain number of points, but you can flip over the tokens to make them less or more, and that's what one of the I don't even want to call them the claw
they're
tokens
called, would let you scar tokens,
the scar tokens would let you do
bonus tokens is
and,
what I would call them.
One some that make, you know, bonus to the value to win the lane. Anyway, all sorts of different things. Interesting different ways to play that mixes up the game.
Yeah, you might think that over the course of the hand in Lone Wolves, because some areas get locked off, either literally because there's no room for any more cards there, or figuratively because someone has such a huge advantage that the other player won't be able to contest it, that would really narrow your range of options. But, and it does to a certain extent, there's still a dynamism there about columns being having their worth changed, about possibly a second trump opening up. And so there is this evolution of the game state in a very, very pleasing way. Big fan. Lone Wolves. Yasuyuki Nakamura, published by Wonderful World Board Games. Yet another strange trick-taking game from a Japanese designer.
So we got back to Fate Forge, Chronicles of Khan, designed by Gordon Clea, put out by Mighty Boards. And this is a campaign game that's app-driven that, you know, has a feel of the earlier games they did, Vengeance, and Vengeance Roll and Write. You're rolling some dice. They have different symbols on them. You're sort of plugging them into these different abilities that you have. and you're moving around this map that you, it's fairly easily to set up. You're using these tokens for the enemies. You can move around, you do your attacks, and you have a little mission. You have a very tight, it's the tight turn limits that do it. You have
yeah.
like two or three turns to get through this map and get to the exit.
Usually more like three or four, but yes. You never feel like you're drowning in time. There's a very, very solid time pressure. But that adds to the impetus, and it keeps things moving quickly. A given scenario in Fate Forge is not going to be longer than about an hour, which is good because there's other stuff that you'll be doing on top of the battle system.
Once again, we could have avoided this.
Maybe.
We should have known that this might have been an option.
Yeah,
we
in hindsight, yeah.
Because this particular person was giving away missions, and we knew that it was going to modify the mission in a certain way.
We had reason to believe,
that
yeah.
That we wouldn't like.
Yes.
So we could have just not done that and moved to something else.
It introduces an artificial restriction whereby you don't get to play with some of your toys. And the fewer toys you have to play with, the more you can feel like at the mercy of a small number of dice rolls. The way you mitigate dice in both Vengeance and in Fate Forge is with these skills that you pick up. And in a campaign system especially, you start to depend on those skills and rely on them, and they not only give you a sense of agency, but they're also the way you exert some degree of flexibility. And being stripped of those is not pleasant. And so it was the situation where the moment we realized what we were getting into, it's like, ugh. Now, I still enjoyed the fight. The core mechanisms are still very satisfying, but it felt like the worst iteration of a system that's very, very good.
Yeah, thankfully we had a normal mission first, so that got us back into the game. There was a little yes. like, is this where we left off? You know, it was sort of one of these things where we had been away for so long, we weren't sure exactly where we were, so that detracted a bit from it. But as soon as we got into the fighting, we were back in, so we got to do a normal mission first and then this odd one, which is why I think we left for quite a while in the first place. It was too bad that we were like once
yeah.
back at it. But hopefully we won't be too deterred and we will have it out on the table.
Well, there's a number of considerations. I still stand behind Fate Forge Chronicles of Khan. Marvelous system, and I think it does the campaign elements relatively well, even though this sort of complication is not one we like. And there was a scene that threatens to invoke a certain sort of narrative conceit that one of us, Huey, really, really strongly dislikes. But setting all that aside, there are two things. Number one, in the session we did, there's this kind of mini game that we've had to play a couple of times where you're moving around on the map. And it's not quite as satisfying or as good as Micro Macro Crime City. There's certainly not as much personality, but it has some of the same vibes. You're following along the map. You're trying to work on some cues because the theme of Fate Forge Chronicles of Khan is that you are strangers in this large city. You're not native there. You don't know where anything is. And so you're kind of stumbling around discovering things in a very organic feeling way that feeds the narrative and the sense of discovery, and all without employing one of my least favorite tropes in all of fantasy storytelling, which is the convenient amnesia. But anyway, setting all that aside, so you spread out the map and the app tells you what you see and you have a vague sense of where you're trying to go or a vague sense of what you're trying to find, and you're looking at the map like freaking tourists and stumbling around. I quite enjoy it. If you had described it to me in those terms, I wouldn't have thought that I would enjoy that gameplay aspect of Fate Forge, but I love it. And it was very satisfying. We stumbled into what we needed and we learned a little bit about the city in the process. Very, very well done. The other thing to keep in mind about Fate Forge Chronicles of Khan is that since launch, they've finally implemented the battle system where you can have one-off fights that are disconnected from the main game. I think over the course of the next couple weeks, if we don't decide to do this ourselves, I'm going to try to do that solo because I'm very curious to see how that's implemented. And I'd like to see, again, how much you get to play with the additional skills. I've always been interested in campaign systems that involve in slow, steady progression of acquiring new abilities and new equipment, how they are able to instantiate pick-up one-offs without just being like, you're a level one nobody, have a level one nobody fight. You know, it's like not entirely unlike you the way you get rapid progression in a game like Slay the Spire, for example. So I'm very curious how they've done the battle system. The app has been updated several times, a number of quality of life improvements, as well as this new battle system. So that is Fate Forge Chronicles of Khan by Gordon Kalea and Mighty Boards. Looking forward to staying back into it. It had been too long. Played another game of Duos. Duos is by Johannes Schmidauer Koenig, and it is being republished by CMYK as part of their Magenta line. This is a review copy we got from the publisher. This is the partnership-based recipe fulfillment game. And again, recipe fulfillment is something we've been doing a lot over the course of the past few years. But if you're going to be doing it, you might as well have it in a breezy format where there's some vaguely interesting partner dynamics. Duos is one of those games where the moment I take a step back from it, I kind of forget how pleasant it is in the moment. It's just so simple and so frankly basic that I'm always amazed when I sit down to play it again. It's like, hey, this is really fun. It's just a very, very pleasant social experience, and the team dynamic adds just that extra little spice that elevates it, despite the fact that it really is quite so bone simple.
Yeah, try to figure out what your partner has. You can see what their mission is. You can see that they need, you know, two pairs of magenta even numbers. So like either two twos, two fours, or two sixes. And you can see three cards that are in the offer. So you can see what they're taking. And then you can decide, you look what's in your hand. And you're allowed to pass them two cards. So you're either drawing to try to fulfill your goal or the goal in the center. And so either draw cards that you know they need from the offer, and then you just maybe you need random ones off of the top of the deck.
Yeah, there's a fair amount of drawing random cards off the top of the deck. It was weird. I felt very strange during the game of Duos, not in an unpleasant way, whereby the overwhelming majority of missions that our team satisfied were satisfied by my partner. In fact, I think I only, of the 9 or 10 missions that we satisfied collectively, I think I satisfied one or two, and one of them was even a common mission, not even my personal one. It's just the first one that I drew, we kept waiting for the deck to satisfy it, and just never happened. But that having been said, I spent the entire time just feeding my partner the cards that they needed, and so consequently, even though we won, I felt like I wasn't doing much. It was strange. Again, not in an unpleasant way, but it's that team play aspect that really does elevate the simplicity of the card play. We are fans of all the magenta games that are coming out from CMYK. I think Figment is still my favorite, but Duos definitely has a certain charm to it. And so it was suggested in this case because we had four players, which is not a very common configuration here at Sober Wrong About Games. And sure enough, you can only play with four or six. So the restricted player count, I think, is one downside to Duos, but had a great time with it.
I got to show Mark Creature Caravan. This is a Ryan Lockett game by Red Raven Games. It's one of those sort of mystical reveal games where it's like, oh, I have the Toad Archer Berserker, or oh, my caravan's now being pulled by raptors, you know, that sort of thing. Unfortunately, this particular session did fall into that sort of deck milling that I hate. I particularly needed a bunch of undead-type creatures to satisfy not getting a bunch of negative points, so I had to try to get five of them out, so I had to cycle through the deck in order to get those five.
Yeah, I'm surprised, because when you initially described Creature Caravan to me, it sounded to me like a deck milling game, and I asked you, how is this not a deck milling game? And you said, it doesn't feel like one. It feels like you have enough opportunities to get cards. That was not my experience. I don't object to the thing that you identify as deck milling. I don't have a problem with it, but I would say that this is a very paradigmatic deck.
In the first game I had, I did not have those issues. I didn't get as many cards that you needed. I had a few.
Oh, you had fewer combinatoric cards
exactly
pulled. I see.
And the ones I did get, only needed one or two, and I normally already had those in my hand, so it wasn't that I was always searching for the cards I needed.
So they came pre-milled?
Just so.
Okay, understood.
Pre-milled. But anyway, very interesting art. The premise is to try to get your caravan across the board. The further you get it, the more points you get. If you get right to the end, you get even more points. There's these ember zombies that you're going to pick up along the way that you have to kill right away. There's lots of trading for bread. Lots of bread in this world, Mark.
Yeah.
So much bread.
So much bread.
Everyone loves bread.
Oh, yeah. You got to have bread.
They don't love it as much as they love fruit. They really love fruit.
Well, they only want
the fruit.
But
it's so scarce.
They only want the fruit the one time.
It's true.
But they'll keep eating bread.
Yeah.
It's like the breadsticks at Olive Garden.
Yeah.
They're just going to go to town. I don't know. I was a little disappointed by the artwork. Ryan Lockett is such a whimsical artist. And yeah, there are bits of whimsy. You know, there's the giant bat that you're riding, but it's just a big bat, all right? Then there's the cool pig man, and he's awesome. But next to him is some dude with a beard, and I'm told he's a wizard. Okay. Sam the wizard. All right, fine. So the ratio of, like, really cool whimsical cards to non-whimsical cards is a little off for my taste. And also, the thematic elements were a complete hash. Like, the attempt to explain how combat works is so absurd as to really just highlight the extent to which this is just one other thing that they needed to have in the game. It could have been anything. It didn't need to be combat. They're like, oh, ember zombies. They're flaming zombies. Okay, fine. Whatever you say, Ryan Lockett. It's your game. On top of that, I think I would have preferred things if there was a slightly greater focus on the movement aspect. The people that you put on your tableau, it just felt like a generic tableau builder too much of the time. It was the map movement that I think elevated it slightly from just being a super generic tableau builder experience. And so the cards that I preferred, the people that I thought were really interesting, were the ones that gave you new movement capabilities or altered your existing movement capabilities. For example, you had a card that said, if you have the necessary keywords, you can move up or down once on a turn for free. Now, given that mostly you get points by going from left to right as opposed to up or down, this just gave you more flexibility as opposed to just sheer progress. I had a card called the Sphinx that allowed you to move down the diagonal, which was, quite frankly, amazing. And I just wish that they leaned a little bit more into that caravan aspect and the movement aspect of the traversal necessities. Maybe had a little bit more complexity there and a little less about this trading element, which was a little strange and a little forced and a little arbitrary. Why is it the case that having somebody else purchase bread for 5 coins means that I can't purchase bread for 5 coins? Oh, no, whatever. Okay, fine. Sure. Well, I killed a zombie with 7 combat strength. That means that nobody else can kill a zombie with 7 combat strength anymore. And you can only kill 1 zombie around, so if you encounter 2 zombies in the same time, the other zombie's just going to follow you around forever like you're the Grateful Dead or something. Sure, fine, whatever. I mean, it all works. It's not confusing. It's just aggressively themeless. And if you try to poke at the thematicity, it becomes increasingly incoherent. And it just didn't lean into its strengths. The strengths are the world that it's trying to build with the fabulous creatures, not the normal dudes like Sam. Sam's fine. He did his job. I got nothing against Sam. But Sam the Wizard doesn't cut it when you could add, set a glorious lizard man thief. Like, give me more of those.
And then there's the fiddliness of after every round, you have to move all these cubes down one space. And it was just...
I mean, well, that was actually the thing that I liked most about Creature Caravan. It moved at a very, very good clip.
Yes.
Play is almost entirely simultaneous. The round structure such that it is you roll the dice, you use the dice, you maybe move 1 or 2 cubes, and there you go. That's the round structure. Time to roll your dice again. And so I never really felt like I was dealing with upkeep. So that part I appreciated, so... I don't know. All told, I was hopeful for a little bit more whimsy and a little bit more leaning into the good bits. I did like the good bits, but ultimately I felt the Creature Caravan didn't do enough to differentiate it from a whole bunch of other generic tableau builders.
That's Creature Caravan.
Those are the games we played last week. Now a brief break to pay some bills.
This podcast is sponsored by IQ Bar.
I've got good news and bad news. Here's the bad news. Most protein bars are packed with sugar and unpronounceable ingredients. The good news? There's a better option. I'm Will, and I created IQ Bar Plant Protein Bars to empower doers like you with clean, delicious, low-sugar brain and body fuel. IQ Bars are packed with 12 grams of protein, brain nutrients like magnesium and lion's mane, and zero weird stuff. And right now, you can get 20% off all IQ Bar products, plus free shipping. Try our delicious IQ Bar sampler pack with 7 plant protein bars, 4 hydration mixes, and 4 enhanced coffee sticks. Clean ingredients, amazing taste, and you'll love how you feel. Refuel smarter, hydrate harder, caffeinate larger with IQ Bar.
Go to eatiqbar.com and enter code BAR20 to get 20% off all IQ Bar products, plus free shipping. Again, go to eatiqbar.com and enter code BAR20.
And we're back. And now on to the news and why it doesn't matter. Once again, SwagCon.
SwagCon, it's coming.
Congrès, so very wrong about games. Fun times, good vibes only, trans rights or human rights board game jamboree. Working title. I think it's a little too short. This is going to be in Kingston, Ontario. Sorry. From July 25th, 26th, 27th. Well, it's not an easy place to get to, Walker.
True.
the number of times I've had people, either personal friends or other people in the context of SwagCon, it's like, oh, you have an airport there that no planes go to. That is correct.
But true, it is in between 2 big cities, though.
I will point out, for people who are inclined, if getting to upstate New York is easier, we are only about an hour away from the Watertown, New York airport, which only flies to Philadelphia. But, and from that, you need a car. I don't know. I'm not going to tell you how to get here. We already have a good number of registrants. If you are a patron of So Very Wrong About Games, then you can engage in early registration. We're going to open up general registration in a couple weeks. Very pleased to see you there. I can confirm that the following guests have been invited: Parker Posey, Ellie Mistal, and Alyssa Edwards. None of them are aware we exist, but they're invited. We got to have special guests.
Yes, you got to have.
Got to have Buzz. Anybody else? Anyone else? Any other special guests that people think that I should invite? Living or dead, they're not going to come. I can invite any of them.
It's true.
Who do you want me to invite, Walker?
I don't know. They've probably done something terrible, so I better not say anything.
How about the original cast of Rent?
Nice.
Yeah, we have also invited the original cast of Rent. Next up, Mike Hutchison, the designer of Gaslands and A Billion Suns, very interesting tabletop designer, has talked about his upcoming crowdfunding projects. And one of the things that he's going to be doing is crowdfunding his game Space Gits. Space Gits is a game of drunken space orcs. It combines dexterity elements. Let me tell you how shots work, Walker. You take your shot dice, number of shot dice based on what kind of weapon you're using. Obviously, a higher rate of fire means more shot dice. You roll the dice, and the bullets travel in the direction of the die from your original figure, and they go in a straight line until they hit something, based on the range of the weapon. That's how shots work, Walker.
Nice.
It's a dexterity miniatures game. I'm going to try to convince Walker to play Space Gits with me soon, but it's going to be on crowdfunding before too long. If you are a patron of Planet Smasher Games, which is Mike Hutchinson's designer label, then you have early access to a beta version, which looks very polished. There's going to be more balance, of course, but there's already rules for vehicles. Can't have space orcs without vehicles.
No.
Got to have that stuff. And all manner of army building options. I'm quite impressed with it. Looking forward to getting it to the table. Mike Hutchison, Space Gits, Planet Smasher Games. Interesting stuff.
Go ahead. And that's the news and why it doesn't matter. Now to our feature game, which is Reiner Knizia's Rebirth.
Rebirth was published by Mighty Boards pursuant to successful crowdfunding last year. It is a tile-laying game. Reiner Knizia has done many tile-laying games. Reiner Knizia has done many games in general. Walker, why don't you tell us? Why don't you give us an unhelpful summary about what one does in Rebirth?
In Rebirth, on your turn, you'll be placing one tile that you drew, placing it on a hex map, and you
Wait. You'll be playing one tile from your hand of tiles, right?
No hand, Mark. One tile.
One tile?
That you drew.
Oh.
So you know one tile, and you're going to play that tile. And you're going to play it on a hex map, and you must match the symbols up. The larger area of tiles that are the same, the more points you're going to receive. Villages are going to score when completed, and whoever has the most influence there will get the most points. The game will end once all tiles have been placed. Wait a second. I've read the Carcassonne unhelpful summary. Oh, wait, there's a note here. It says, same as Carcassonne, except say something, blah, 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 castles, something, something, cathedrals.
No, Tilly Walker, you're entirely wrong. You're for one thing, this has a hex map, whereas Carcassonne does not have a hex map. In Carcassonne, you have to construct the cities, whereas here you're competing over pre-existing cities, and also you represent some sort of weird, abstracted, vastly powerful being. This is Mage Knight, Walker.
Oh, it's me.
This isn't Carcassonne, this is Mage Knight.
So there's two different games inside the Rebirth box. You can either play the Scotland map, or you can play the Ireland map, and there are a lot of things that are similar between the two things, but there are also key differences that make them very different and one much better than the other. And we prefer the Ireland side of the map.
We are making no judgment as to the country or the people they're in, but we prefer the Ireland map.
On the Ireland side, you have a bunch of gold cards, which are at the top of the map that you can satisfy. And there are also, you can also... There are also towers that when you place beside will give you special abilities, which will give you combos, which make this side much more interesting.
Can I start with an incredibly petty complaint, Walker?
You sure can.
So these tiles that are placed on the map at the start of the game on the Ireland board that trigger when you place next to them for the first time, they are called round tiles. They're not round.
They're not round.
And they do not relate to rounds of the game. I generally think that the term round tile should be avoided wherever possible. I still remember the first time I was reading the rulebook to Terra Mystica, and I was talking about the round scoring tiles. And I'm like, where are the round scoring tiles? What I was looking at everything that was round. I couldn't find the round scoring tiles. Oh, no, the round scoring tiles are rectangular. But they refer to that then. So ever since then, I always get confused. It talks about a round tile. It's like, wait, are you talking about round as in the shape of the thing or the overall structure? I guess I give credit for Rebirth to breaking the mold and it referring to neither.
Anyway, I love it.
Petty complaint over.
They're called the round tower bonus tiles. And every time they talk about them, they call it by the full name. The round tower bonus tiles.
They're not round. The towers are presumably round. We don't see the towers, of course. We just see the tiles.
And there's two different decks of cards depending on the sides of the map that you're playing on. And I find the gold cards, and they're both sort of the gold cards in a certain way, but the ones on the Scotland side seem fairly arbitrary and boring, whereas the ones on the Ireland side are very interesting. More ways to block people because they're the same for everyone. You can see where someone's about to score one, or you can completely block one off. There are three 13-point markers randomly on the board, and as soon as you have a tile beside all three, then you get 13 points. So if you surround one, that means no one else is going to get that goal.
Conversely, as you're playing on the Scotland map, you pick up a private goal every time you place next to a cathedral for the first time. And these start on the map at fixed points. And some of them you might have already achieved by accident. Some of them might be entirely impossible by the time you pick them up, even in the early game, because other people just pursuing other goals happened to preclude you being able to score that. And so it always felt vaguely arbitrary and not leading to satisfying player interaction. Whereas in the Ireland map, you have these public goals that everyone gets to compete from the beginning, and you get to see what's available, and that is an additional layer of texture to determining where you want to place. In other words, it improves the decision space and the player interaction all at the same time, therefore vastly to be preferred as far as I'm concerned.
And so there's also this constant tension about fighting over all these different castles. There's all these different purple castle spaces littered across the map, and every time you place a tile...
Strewn.
Every time you place a tile beside one, if no one else has yet, you get to put this nice castle miniature in that hex. And then it's sort of this area majority. Whoever has the most tokens around that particular castle, and so it's, you know, switches back and forth, and then until it's locked down. And it's sometimes it leads to end game shenanigans where it's like, well, I only have a few places left, I'm just going to, you know, steal that castle or do certain things. And no matter what side of the map, I find the end game sort of breaks down, I think, for maybe the last three or four tiles.
Yeah, I'm inclined to agree. So the fundamental objection that I have to the Scotland map, and to a certain extent that this applies to Ireland, but it applies more to Scotland, is the triangular scoring is so compelling that you're seldom in a position that you would ever consider violating that pattern. So there are these clusters of spaces where you might be able to put farms out. First farm you put out is 1 point. Second farm, if it's adjacent to the first, gives you two more, and then three more, and then four more, and then five more. And it's very easy, even in a four-player game, to get to five, six, seven-size farms. Why on earth would I ever break from my own little farm when I have pulled a farm tile, because again, you're just pulling a hand of one tile, to go mess with somebody's private goal, to go mess with somebody's own energy tiles? Like, oh, look, someone has a huge energy farm. They're getting a lot of points from it. Maybe I should throw my points into the dumpster so I can throw their points in the dumpster. No, that's ridiculous. You just go on and do your thing, which is fine, except for the fact that it really leans into the sensation that you're just playing the obvious play without much player interaction. And absent the public goals, absent some of that tension, it just feels like it plays itself. Now, it's perfectly smooth and kind of pleasant. I don't strongly object to it, but I don't really feel like I'm making many decisions. And ultimately, the charm of the components are pulling a lot of the weight.
Yeah, sometimes you get that really unique, interesting play where not only are you completing, you know, your farm, making it bigger, but you're also blocking off someone else. But at the same time, you're getting the majority around a castle. Every so often, there are those moves, or you're, you know, getting a goal card at the same time, or a castle and a goal card at the same time. But a lot of times, it's the obvious move.
Yeah. Whereas when playing the Ireland board, the public goals and seeing what my opponents were doing really put me on difficult decisions. And you layer on top of that the round towers. That also put some constraints, because some of those I wanted to trigger early, some of them I wanted to trigger late. Like one, for example, first time you place next to it, nothing happens. If you place next to its pair, its twin, somewhere else randomly placed on the map, you get to put a doubler over a public objective, and that public objective will be worth twice as many points. However, you cannot put that doubler on an objective you've already satisfied. And so there's this very interesting timing constraint where it's like, okay, I need to work towards a public goal. I need to make sure that I'm closer to finishing that than anybody else on the table. And at the same time, I need to make sure that I'm placing next to these towers, all the while trying trying to maximize my triangular scoring opportunities. But suddenly you've got so many more considerations that feed into it. Ultimately, your turn is still going to be dead simple. I drew a farm. I'm going to place a farm. That's all there is to it. But the timing considerations, what you want to do first, what you're going to be working towards, are suddenly vastly more interesting on the Ireland board.
That is because the first person to complete a goal gets a large amount of points, and then everyone else is going to get the smaller amount. And so if you put out that doubler too soon, someone could score the larger amount before you have a chance to cash in on that doubler.
Absolutely.
But that's never happened. Mark would never do that to me.
No. No, that sounds like the act of a madman or some sort of sociopath.
So overall, Rebirth just looks fantastic.
It's gorgeous, yes.
The castles look great. The cathedrals stack up on the Scotland side as more people, you know, engage with getting their public cards. You know, it's much like the towers in Carcassonne. They, you know, fit perfectly into each other, so they make this nice big stack. You know, you have these little groups of farms, little groups of power farms. Just the map alone, the board alone looks fantastic as well. It's this weird dystopian. The world has fallen.
It's actually kind of like a post-apocalyptic utopianism, actually. Frankly, they talk about how civilization has fallen and now you're rebuilding it in harmony with nature kind of thing. It's kind of like post-apocalyptic Ginkopolis, you know, conservationist in balance with nature futurism sort of deal.
But Scotland and Ireland have gone back to the clan system.
Yeah, I'm not sure and how.
So you have these groups of people. And once again, like every other post-apocalyptic thing, you cannot work together.
Nope.
Impossible. So you're competing against each other. Very easy to teach.
Very quick as well. Very, very fast game.
And I think that's part of it. I know we hated the fact that you only had a hand of one, but I think if that changed at all, it would completely change the, not only the flow of the game, but the dynamic of the game. Because if you had a choice of so many, you could, you know, finish that one thing you wanted or cut that person off that you needed to. Whereas if you only had one, you have to like decide where that one is going to go. I really feel as though it would change the game up.
Actually, do you know what would make the game even faster? If nobody had a hand size. There you go. Then the game's faster.
There you go. That's true.
You just put the tile in a random... How about if you put the tile in a random place?
That you just grab one and flick it where it falls.
Yeah, absolutely. Look, I'm just being flip. Playing Scotland board really made me appreciate Babylonia more. Because that triangular scoring is one of the aspects of Babylonia, and I wasn't a huge fan, again, of how that incentivizes you to just double down on the area that you're already making. And blocking only makes sense in conjunction with some of the other mechanisms of the game. And Scotland doesn't really have those other mechanisms. And so blocking isn't much of a consideration, and the player interaction is so minimal, and the decision space so narrow, I didn't see much of the point. And it made me appreciate Babylonia all the more, because Babylonia, I think, is pretty good, but a lot of people think that it's among Knizia's best. I'm just not there with them. The Ireland version, I think, is a much more substantial game and a much more satisfying gameplay experience. And it is one that I would willingly go back to. Honestly, if somebody suggested now, especially at this point, it's like, hey, let's play the Scotland version. It's our first time playing. It's just our first time, so we'll play the Scotland version. Like, no, I would never consent to play the Scotland version ever again. The Ireland version, I think, is strictly superior and definitely one that I'd play more. I hear what you're saying about the time virtues of a single tile hand. I still think I'd prefer a slightly wider decision space. I don't think this ranks among the top-tier Reiner Knizia tile layers. And even in the context of solid, enjoyable Knizia tile layers, like your Babylonia, like your Blue Lagoon, I don't think that it ranks near the top of those even.
No, but I think for simplicity and ease of teach, I think it's definitely in a category of its own, for sure.
I don't know. Blue Lagoon has... The scoring is a little bit more complicated than I'd like, but it is absolutely very simple. And so part of me, I think, would rank them equivalently
True.
In terms of weight.
But sort of understanding the weight of the two phases might be a little more difficult for some.
You're right. But that's what makes it so fascinating.
It does. Once they've played a couple times,
We can agree that Through the Desert is as easy or easier in terms of rules load.
Yes.
There you go. Play Through the Desert.
Yeah, well, obviously.
Obviously, yeah. Well, no, that's part of the problem, right?
Yes.
If you want to play a really, really excellent Reiner Knizia tile laying game, I've got half a dozen for you.
It's
and
true.
Then maybe I've got a half a dozen more, and then maybe I'll start thinking about Rebirth.
It's true.
All right. So
these are things that are true.
So his core, his famous like trilogy or quadrilogy, depending on how you want to put it, Through the Desert, Tigris and Euphrates, Samurai, Stevenson's Rocket. Those are my four favorite of his tile laying games. I love Blue Lagoon. I've got an increased appreciation now for Babylonia. Those are like off the top of my head, probably his six best tile laying games. Those are the ones you should go for first. If you love all those and you want some more, hey, maybe give Rebirth a try. But I mean, frankly, it's a crowded field. It's tough. And I sincerely recommend skipping the Scotland map.
Agreed.
That is Rebirth. And that is going to do it for So Very Wrong About Games. Thank you so much for joining us. We appreciate your deciding to spend some of your valuable time and attention on our little offering of something that, let's face it, is barely better than a bunch of fart noises. We hope to see you again soon.
Barely.
Peace! You've been listening to So Very Wrong About Games, a board gaming podcast about board games produced by Michael Walker and edited by Mark Bickman. You can find all our information at sowronggames.com. Special thanks to What Does It Eat for allowing us to use their most excellent song, FOS, as our intro. You can find them at whatdoesiteat.com. We hope to see you again soon, and as always, try to be right, but remember, you're so very wrong.
Why is life better with American Family Insurance? Because every policy comes with something very special. A trusted agent who's there to help protect your dreams by finding the right coverage at the right price. Save up to 23% when you bundle home and auto. American Family Insurance. Get a quote and find an agent at AmFam.com.
Products not available in every state. Visit AmFam.com to learn how discounts may apply to you. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.
This podcast is sponsored by IQBar.
I've got good news and bad news. Here's the bad news. Most protein bars are packed with sugar and unpronounceable ingredients. The good news? There's a better option. I'm Will, and I created IQ Bar Plant Protein Bars to empower doers like you with clean, delicious, low-sugar brain and body fuel. IQ Bars are packed with 12 grams of protein, brain nutrients like magnesium and lion's mane, and zero weird stuff. And right now, you can get 20% off all IQ Bar products, plus free shipping. Try our delicious IQ Bar sampler pack with 7 plant protein bars, 4 hydration mixes, and 4 enhanced coffee sticks. Clean ingredients, amazing taste, and you'll love how you feel. Refuel smarter, hydrate harder, caffeinate larger with IQ Bar.
Go to eatiqbar.com and enter code BAR20 to get 20% off all IQ Bar products, plus free shipping. Again, go to eatiqbar.com and enter code BAR20.